Accession number 12502, Reel 8.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Reel 8. I think your next appointment was as an instructor at the Staff College. Yeah. This was 1958.
That's right. Yes, yes, I was there a very long time, of course, because I went there quite young. I was 34. And in those days, of course, you were only a local lieutenant colonel. And I'd commanded two companies, and I was not within striking distance of commanding a battalion, because in those days you didn't get command of a battalion until you were about 41. Since then, of course, it's been brought forward to 38 or something like that. But in those days, you weren't likely to get command of a battalion before you were about 41. And here was I at 34. I'd done my grade 2 staff job. I had done commanded two companies. I had war experience. And so I had supposed to be a certain amount of time to fill in. I was made a brevet lieutenant colonel, which existed in those days, about halfway through my time. But I did a full 3 to 3.5 years at the Staff College. And I came out as a brevet lieutenant colonel, did a very short time as second in command of my battalion. Battalion, incidentally, it had three lieutenant colonels in it, the proper commanding officer and two brevets. And then I went and did my grade 1 staff job, and then after that I commanded a battalion. So I had 3.5 years at the Staff College. I taught in 3 of those years, and the last one I was the job of what was called G2 TAC Coord, and I really did the sort of tactical coordination, doctrine and things like that, which led on to me later getting a job as the author of the Land Battle series. But I had 3 years of teaching and battlefield tours and all the things that were going on there.
When you went back to Staff College as an instructor, did you find that the syllabus had changed a great deal from the time you'd been there as a student?
My impression is not very greatly. Not very greatly. We still did the sort of major defensive exercises. And, but, of course, we were moving. Yes, we still did the same river crossing exercise, the same defence object, but we were now moving, of course, into the nuclear field. What effect were nuclear weapons going to have on the battlefield?
Who was actually doing the main thinking about that? Was that being done at the Staff College by instructors there, or was it being done at high level in military operations?
Quite a lot of it was being done at the Staff College. And I think in the sense that we got it wrong, and I think we had reasons to get it wrong, because of course the balance of nuclear power was so different than it became later on. I mean, all the nuclear weight was really on the Allied side, the NATO side, and so we really got ourselves thinking in deep terms on a tactical nuclear battle, which I don't actually think it was ever a practical starter, but we started to work out how you would deploy your forces and react if you used tactical nuclear weapons on enemy concentrations, and maybe they used some of them on you. And we developed this to a fine art. I think in latter years showed that it really wasn't very much of a starter, this, and that once you'd started nuclear weapons, you were going to escalate into the strategic field. But we did look about exactly the effects of tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield, the sort of dispersion you needed, the sort of command arrangements that you needed to do this. the sort of drills that you had to have for introducing your nuclear weapons into the fire plan. And all this was being done at the Staff College at that time.
What sort of sources were you using as your for your basic assumptions? Were you looking at American theories of nuclear warfare, or were you looking at the writings of people like Sir John Slessor and other native theorists?
We were looking at comparatively small yield weapons. We were looking at, roughly speaking, the yield of the weapons at Hiroshima, that sort of thing, and smaller ones, of course. And there were weapons such as Davy Crockett, which was merely a large mortar firing a small sub-kiloton weapon. So we were looking at all those sort of weapons. I mean, it was going to be a sort of very decent, not decent, but it was going to be a very coherent land battle with nuclear weapons. Later on, some of us got to feel that you couldn't have a coherent land battle with nuclear weapons at all, and the whole thing was going to then break up into a break-and-back affair.
Did you have any liaison with the Air Force Staff College about this question of the integration of nuclear weapons into war fighting in Europe?
Oh, yes, I'm sure we did. And, of course, at that time, am I right in thinking? I'm just trying to think when... Yes, we were... certainly, of course, the Air Force were the prime deliverer of the strategic weapon with the V-bomber force in those days. And their eyes were on a different bit of the battle. I mean, I don't think it was ever anticipated that they would use nuclear weapons in conjunction with the battle. This was all going to be fired from ground-delivered weapons. When all else failed, but as you had the advantage in these things, you were thinking in those days pretty well on what I call a tripwire concept. You know, you had your tripwire, and then you were expecting the enemy to think that you were then going to go into the nuclear business pretty quickly
on a strategic basis.
No. Well, you wouldn't obviously tell him which order you were going to do these things, because uncertainty was the name of the game. But the land commanders were prepared to go onto a nuclear basis. I mean, if you were attacked by several armored divisions, once you identified it, you were going to go quite early onto this basis. Later on, of course, it was realized it would be suicide for you to do this, and therefore you had to strengthen your forces. But these things go in waves, and that time... And, of course, Duncan Sands, who came in just after the Suez operation, thought that you could have a wholesale reduction of your ground forces and do the whole thing with nuclear. And even Winston Churchill thought that somehow we ought to be modernizing and doing, you know, with these economical weapons, we should be doing more with the nuclear weapons and less with large conventional forces.
Earlier on in the 50s, I seem to remember...
But then we had the advantage, remember, and of course later on, with parity, the thing began to look very different.
I think earlier on, in the earlier 50s, there had been the idea that the NATO forces in Europe, if attacked by greatly superior conventional forces of the Warsaw Pact, would fall back to the Rhine, to the Loire, eventually to the Pyrenees, that the air forces would deliver atomic and nuclear strikes on the rear areas of the Soviet bloc, and that having been reinforced across the Atlantic, the NATO forces would then conduct a counteroffensive starting from the Pyrenees, perhaps even across Channel Salt.
You slightly mystify me on that. I never saw it quite in those terms at all.
I think this was a plan, an idea that was developing within NATO around about 1952, 53, that era, which would obviously be invalid if the idea was that you would depend upon strategic nuclear deterrence and not bother with large conventional forces.
Well, I think, I mean, I agree with, as I've just said, on the question of large, of reducing your conventional forces, but I never got involved in anything which indicated that you might go back, certainly further back than the Rhine. I agree, there was probably going to be more space used inside Germany, and the obsession with forward defence hadn't occurred at that time. Forward defence, of course, was something that... Forward defence was something that, of course, increased as Germany gained in... the Federal Republic gained in self-confidence, because they said, well, it's all right for you, but, I mean, we can't make plans which is voluntarily going to surrender the large part of our population to the enemy. And so forward defence came in. This hadn't come in at this stage, but they were considering such extraordinary military manoeuvres as bastions, in which you had these great sort of areas on of a division, even a corps strength, with large areas in between into which you put your nuclear weapons. But to my mind, well, it all occurred somewhere between the Elbe and the Rhine, rather than right back to the Pyrenees, and certainly the French would never have tolerated a concept which went right back to the Pyrenees. I mean, their idea was to make sure nuclear weapons were used, it didn't matter on whom, before the enemy got onto the soil of France. I would question that concept, but the idea that you use nuclear weapons quite soon and tended to win the battle with nuclear weapons and then did whatever you had to do to recover the ground, yes, that's so. But I think it all happened rather further forward than you suggest.
How long was the Staff College course in those days?
It was a full year. A full year. And personally, I think it was very great pity that since then it has been, bits have been lopped off in every sort of way. And the Shrivenham course, which came in when I was there, of course, was tucked on to the front of it. That is to say, you went to Shrivenham. If you were going to Shrivenham, and not everybody went to Shrivenham in those days, those were what I call the two stream people. But they went to Shrivenham from September to Christmas, and then they came to the Staff College for the whole year, and that lasted from January to Christmas time. And I think it was an extremely good course.
What was the method of instruction principally employed? Was it the syndicate?
Oh yes, much thing, the syndicate, that's right. And I ran an exercise called New Look, which was sort of all the sort of forward thinking, not so much all the sort of new weapons and things that might be coming in the period 10, 20 years ahead, in order to try to get people thinking on this. It was really a way of provoking ideas. I also dealt with the whole morale factor, and I ran one of the battlefield tours, and of course I took a syndicate. But I think it was a very, very good course. We had some extremely good instructors, all of whom nearly subsequently became generals, and quite high generals as well. And many of my students have done very well as well, in all three services. But we had people from the Navy and the Air Force. I think it was an excellent course, and I'm sorry it had been cut about. One improvement has been made, though, is that they have, as well as the Staff College course now, of course, got this higher command course, and that has been something that I've always been for, because I've never thought that we studied higher command sufficiently.
How did you actually assess your students on this course? Did you observe their conduct in syndicate, or did you place your main reliance upon the quality of their written work?
Well, you had four ways, really. you had the ones, their contribution in syndicate. And of course, that told you something, but of course, it might also have told you they had a gift of the gab. You assessed their written work, which also told you something, but it didn't necessarily tell you whether they were going to be future chiefs of staff or good commanders, but you did have that, of how accurate they were, how painstaking they were, how accurate they were. That told you something about them. You then saw them out on toots, making assessments of ground and situations and having to give out orders, and that obviously was very important and enlightening. And then occasionally you actually saw them, as far as you could do it, taking command positions in telephone battles and things like that, when you saw them actually exercising command or acting as staff officers or doing the things in as realistic a setting as you could make it. And, of course, this has been followed up since those days by having these tactical trainers, where people actually have to take these decisions against live situations played over on tape to them and so on.
Which of the four criteria do you think was the most important?
Well, I suppose the answer is important for what? I mean, the trouble is that, the paragon of virtue is the man who is a really good staff officer and a really good commander. And not an awful lot of who are very good at both. Personality isn't terribly important, and you see that from a bit of all these things. And I think it's a question of then of sort of having horses for courses. I don't exactly know what grading I got at the Staff College. I think I got a pretty good grading because the top people went to the brigade majors and the G2s. So I think I got a very, very good grading. I mean, I don't know exactly what grading I got. I think I got a high one. But I think you weren't really saying this chap is going to be the Corps commander or the CIGS. You're going to say this chap will make a very good brigade major or G2 or command a battalion well or something like that. That's what you were. And I think it was his subsequent career that really decided where he eventually went to. So you were trying to assess him on his merits, his strengths and his weaknesses. And those would be looked at in deciding his appointment, and how he did in those subsequent appointments would decide where he went to the next appointment. And taking the DS, who were all, if people had run a book, which of those DS were going to come out in the very top, I'm not sure you'd necessarily have got it right, It's a combination, isn't it, of quality and experience and how you actually perform in the various jobs that decides where people go.
If it is the case that there is a difference in the qualities required of commanders from staff officers, what is the difference? How do the two types differ?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to be energetic and be very sort of precise and exact to be a very good staff officer. And you certainly must be energetic. And you've got to be able, that's true. But as a commander, you don't have to be quite so energetic, and you don't have to be so precise. You have to be able. You have to have personality. You have to have character and determination. And these are things that are much more important. I don't think that the Montgomerys and the Slims of this world were marvellous staff officers. And some of the people who you can think are absolutely first-class staff officers, de Gangon or someone like that, wouldn't necessarily have made very good commanders. The commander has a quality which you can't absolutely defined. He's got to have very, he's got to be very robust. That is very important. He has got to have this ability to make people do things for him which they otherwise wouldn't do. He's got to have this ability to dominate other people. Those are what that is what is necessary with the good commanders. Now, none of those things are absolutely essential with a staff officer. He's got to be able to interpret his commander's plans and make sure all loose ends are tied up. I mean, you need a clear brain, I think, for both of them. I mean, Monty is a chap who had a very clear brain, and that was useful as a commander. It would have been useful as a staff officer, but as a staff officer, he would have always chafed against the system. I mean, he was too dominant a character. He wasn't, you know, interested in merely seeing that someone above him was doing the thing. He wanted to dominate the situation himself. And then, of course, who do you want as a chief of staff in London? I mean, you need bits of both, because you have to be a staff officer, because the whole art of being a chief of staff is knowing how to use the system. But at the same time, you are the professional head of the army, so you've got to have certain command qualities to be able to impose your will on other people. But there is a difference. And very often you say, well, this chap, you know, will be a marvellous staff officer, or he'd be a very good commander under certain circumstances, but he wouldn't necessarily be a very good commander under different circumstances.
What do you think the qualities are then of a good instructor, having been an instructor yourself and observed instructors in action around you?
What is the art of being an instructor?
What are the qualities required to be an effective instructor, a good instructor?
Well, I think you've got to make, like in being a teacher or anything else, you've got to make whatever it is you're teaching or leading in the syndicate work, you've got to make it fascinating and interesting. Now, you've got to know your stuff. You've got to make it interesting. You've got, I think, to be terribly candid in the sense that you mustn't be bound by the pink. I mean, any instructor who comes in and has it all in front of him and says, well, this is the answer, and don't ask me why it's the answer, but I'm told it is the answer, is going to lose all the confidence of the of his group. He's got to have the confidence and knowledge to be able to say, well, I think your answer is rather better than the one I've got here. And this is why I think it's better. Or, I don't think your answer's as good as the one it's got here, and this is why I don't think it's so good. But you've got to make it live. You've got to make it interesting. You've got to be your own man. I think that's what they want from the teacher. They want an experienced chap who can recall his own experiences, who can occasionally admit he's wrong, but who is his own man and is not just entirely bound with the crib that obviously he's been given to conduct this particular period.
Now, you were saying that you were predicting future developments in technology and obviously using that as a means to provoke your students to discuss current and future tactics. Did you find that your own thinking was very much stimulated by contact with three waves of students coming through the Staff College? Was this a time when you were able to formulate and crystallise new ideas of your own?
Well, I think that's true, because of course one was very much feeling one's own way forward. And I don't detect that when I later on, that was, we're talking now about 58 to 61, and I commanded a division when one was able to put some of these ideas into practice, from 71 to 73, 72 and 73, So that was 15 years later. And I don't detect that a great difference between what we were doing then and what we were trying to formulate. I think a sort of general feeling of a greater mobility, a feeling of closer cooperation between the Army and the Air Force, greater use of things like helicopters in particular areas of the battle, more flexibility and skirmishing in amongst the infantry as opposed to rigid positional defence. I think all these things one was developing, and later on it seems to me that one was more or less trying to carry them out when one commanded a division about 15 years later. I don't think we got anything. I think the only thing I'd say we got wrong was this obsession at that time with the nuclear, the use of nuclear in the land battle. And that, of course, made sense in the balance of terror at the time. It didn't make any sense later on.
Apart from that, was there anything else which had radically affected tactical and operational ideas?
Well, I'll tell you what was coming in then. First of all, all the things like, which we've seen in the Gulf, all the things like radar at land level, infantry radar, which, I mean, before was something that you used to detect when enemy aircraft, but infantry radar, infrared and image intensifiers, and thermal imaging. I think thermally we were a bit ahead of thermal imaging those days, but all these things were beginning to come into use. Better ways of fighting at night, better information about how you got use of drones to get in-flight transmission pictures. And then communications, of course, greatly improved communications. I mean, I think if you went to a desert warrior fighting in the Battle of the Cauldron in 1941, and who then went on to the 60s and even more in the 70s, and say, what is the difference between the British Army, which has had a biggest effect on handling of troops and tactics? They'd say communications. In 1941, you communicated with difficulty, and you really had a very unclear idea of what the enemy were doing. Later on, you had a much clearer idea of what the enemy were doing by these various means of surveillance, and of course your communications were far more reliable, far more flexible, far less vulnerable than they were. So we were exploring all these areas of but also, of course, the enemy counter-communications were much the business of jamming and that sort of thing, a business of detecting where you were, finding you. So you had to have much more sophisticated means of offsetting that. But it was in these fields that my exercise, New Look, was, I think, primarily looking at.
I think then you said that when you'd done 3 years of instruction, you were employed rewriting various tactical manuals.
Mm-hmm.
Were you doing that under instruction from any particular quarter, or were you left to your own devices?
Well, I shall give you now, because I think it is, first of all, one or two things that I wrote on tactics, which I've got out, so you might like to take a copy of. And also, I wrote the first pamphlet in the land battle series called The Application of Force. And I wrote that when I came back after being commanding my battalion. So that would have been in 67. And I came to be the G1 author, which picked up really what I was doing as G2 Cap Coord. But I set the whole pattern for the land battle series, and I wrote this first pamphlet myself. And that really was the... And after that, we had the battle group pamphlet and the brigade and the desert warfare and the jungle warfare. They all were the series. But I think if we could just halt a moment, I'll just...
Do you think that your ideas, as expressed in the pamphlets, were influenced to any extent by the conduct of battlefield tours and the lessons you'd learned on those?
Yes, I think they were, because I never looked upon those battles as being... well, I suppose the Overlord was a sort of one-off thing and rather a specialised battle. But to both Goodwood and Epsom, in their own different ways, did appear to me to be quite modern battles. You could see similar sort of situations occurring if there'd been a conflict in Germany vis-à-vis the Russians. And I think what was particularly interesting about those was the question of the command decisions that were taken at the various times and why the battles went wrong, because both of them to some extent went wrong. On the other hand, there were moments in both battles when the thing went right and you wanted to see why they'd gone right. I mean, one of the most, the best bits of the whole Battle of Epsom was when there had been a series of rather ponderous attacks in some pretty difficult and easily defensible ground, with all the dramas of the troops getting shelled on the start line.